Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, October 30th, 2020. Sudanese protest a hike in prices of fuel across Sudan.
Kasim says increasing the fuel prices adds trouble to people's lives. He says he wishes this step was preceded by consideration of individuals' monthly income.
And South Sudan's National Minister for Gender, Child and Social Welfare says around 60,000 women in South Sudan need treatment for fistula.
This national strategy is a call to realize the fundamental human rights of all women and girls in South Sudan, with a special focus on those most left behind, excluded, and shunned by society. Ending fistula is a high priority for the government and for UNFPA.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some families relocated from Jonglei State to Central Equatorial State due to floods allege their camp for internally displaced persons at Mangala is overcrowded and most families lack water and soap to regularly wash their hands to avoid catching coronavirus. Dr. Richard Laco, incident manager for COVID-19 at the National Ministry of Health, says the ministry is working with some national non-profits to respond to the needs of the IDPs. He says South Sudanese should ensure they protect themselves from the pandemic. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar reports from Juba.
Anyath Panther is one of the residents of Jonglei State who were relocated to Central Equatorial State. He says the elderly and children sit under trees at Mangala IDP camp because some IDPs do not have shelters that would separate people and help reduce transmission of the virus.
We are just in one place. We have a one which is have one shelter when the rain comes. All the people can enter to that shelters.
IDP's community chief, Yak Diu, says facilities to help the IDPs protect themselves from COVID-19 are not always available.
We lack drinking water, let alone water to wash our hands. The only thing we do is for each family to restrict themselves under their own tree and avoid crossing to the other's family. And there is no water for us to wash our hands.
The United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, says it has distributed essential water, sanitation and hygiene items to help the IDPs in Mangala to help prevent the spread of COVID-19. Alan Sanvo is UNICEF's communication officer.
So between 14th and 20th of October, we were able to reach 1,220 of the most vulnerable households in Mangala. It's situated close to the river, so it's possible to take water from the river and use the water purification tablets and powder that we have provided and make that into clean drinking water.
Dr. Richard Laku, incident manager for COVID-19 at the National Ministry of Health, says the ministry, with the help of NGOs, is providing face masks, water containers and hand sanitizers to the IDPs. He says everyone must take responsibility to protect themselves and reduce transmissions of the virus.
This is a responsibility of all of us as the ministries, as the government, as the partners, as stakeholders, including the community themselves, to realize that each and everybody has a role to ensure that we make they themselves are safe, protected, and also when they are protected, we'll make sure that the surrounding communities are protected.
International Organization for Migration, which is leading the humanitarian response in Mangala, says at least 16,000 displaced people have been registered at the Mangala camp. Diatile Potsoa, IOM's media and communications officer, says the organization is working to install water facilities for the IDPs in Mangala.
We're going to help support with the installation of a fully operational water treatment plant. Now, what that plant will do is that we'll be providing clean and safe drinking water for both the IDPs and the host community in Mangala. So that's what IOM will be doing in terms of water and sanitation response in the area.
Putswa says there have been delays in responding to the needs of the IDPs following land and security issues. The EU says many IDPs arrived in Mangala in early August but have yet to be given shelters. And he says there has been a misunderstanding about the size of land to be allotted for each household.
Authorities here say each family will be given 10 by 10 square meters plot of land. And we don't know the date this disease called coronavirus will end. So we complain that 10 by 10 is small. We come from a community where couples give birth to many children, and each family can have more than 15 persons.
Panther, Yak and other IDPs say they have received awareness on how to protect their loved one from COVID-19 way back in Jonglei State before their relocation to Mangala due to floods. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
People in cities across Sudan protested Thursday after the Ministry of Energy doubled the price of fuel to help cut budget deficit. The price of fuel in Sudan has jumped 4 times in 2 years and helped spark mass protest in 2019, which led to the ouster of former President Omar al-Bashir. Naba Mohieddin reports from El Obeid.
Sudan's transitional government raised the price of fuel on Tuesday to help trim a budget deficit and bring an end to fuel shortages. Smugglers were taking advantage of low prices to purchase fuel in Sudan and sell it at a higher price in neighboring countries. Minister of Energy Hayri Abdurrahman said, "We hope this decision will result in the hope for results by creating fuel abundance and stop the smuggling." The price of fuel in Sudan has now jumped 4 times in 2 years. One price hike triggered the mass protest that in 2019 led to the ouster of former President Omar al-Bashir. With the latest increase, diesel will be sold at 46 Sudanese pounds, or about 83 US cents per liter, and regular gas will be sold at 56 pounds per liter. But thousands rallied in Khartoum on Thursday to protest the new prices and call for the government to retract the increase. Ala Gassim is one of the protesters who blocked 2 main bridges Wednesday night in Khartoum. Gassim says increasing the fuel prices adds trouble to people's lives. He says he wishes this step was preceded by consideration of individuals' monthly income. People should take a strong stand against this pricing and totally reject it, he adds. Protester Abdul Karim Hassan, who stopped his car in on the Fitiha Bridge Wednesday, seems determined to make the government back down. Hassan says he was one of the anti-Bashir protesters. He hoped for change. He says he will participate in protests and all resisting campaigns until the transitional government back off on its decision or increases salaries or leaves. Economic analysts like Professor Muhammad Al-Nair think this decision is unfortunate and avoidable in the current time. Muhammad says the decision is indeed unfortunate and the economic situation in Sudan isn't ready for such a decision. He says it's possible to take such a step if economic stabilization was accomplished, with stabilizing the exchange rates and decreasing inflation rates. The U.S. has agreed to remove Sudan from its list of state sponsors of terrorism, a move that should give Sudan access to international loans and create new ties with countries and investors. The government is hoping that move will push the economy, which has struggled for years under the weight of political isolation and U.S. sanctions. Naba Mohieddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
Still in Sudan, Sovereign Council Chairman Abdel Fattah al-Burhan said, having Sudan's name struck off the American terrorist list means the country can return to the international community and benefit economically and obtain advanced technology. Burhan says it will also allow the international community to help Sudan. Khaydir Haroun, former Sudanese ambassador to the United States, explains to VOA's senior analyst Muhammad Al-Ashanawi what sort of economic gains Sudan could see now that it's not on the list.
This is partially true. The delisting of Sudan from the list of the countries accused by the Americans of supporting international terrorism will pave the way for benefiting for the first time from the debt relief. The IMF and World Bank have a special designation known as Initiative for Heavy Indebted Poor Countries, HIBIC, that have high level of heavy debt, making them eligible to receive special assistance. Sudan is among those countries, but due to being in that list, the United States has been using its veto for any attempt to make Sudan benefit from that relief. Secondly, Sudan has been for decades conducting business outside of the international banking system. Around 3 million Sudanese in diaspora still cannot transfer money to their relatives in Sudan through banks and vice versa. I mean, students cannot receive support from their families through the international banking system. Sudan can now be eligible to take development loans from the World Bank and IMF and could join WTO. All of that was hinging on this delisting. Sudan now can buy spare parts for its crippled airlines and locomotives. I said partially in the beginning because the consequential factor is whether the government will prepare the right and effective policy to make those benefits materialize, because, you know, there are conditions to benefit from the HIBIC initiative, which include also very austerity policies, such as curbing the government expenses and also removing subsidies from a lot of major commodities in the country. So it is still conditioned to the what the government economic policies would be.
To charge that the announced normalization with Israel is a betrayal of the Arab national cause and the Palestinians, Al-Burhan said that we all want a Palestinian state in the pre-1967 borders, but we do not want Sudan to bear the whole responsibility for that. What's your take on that?
Commenting on what Burhan had said, no one has asked Sudan to carry the burden alone of the Palestinian people. I believe what is needed is that Sudan and international community should have been steadfast in their adherence to the United Nations Security Council resolutions 224 and 338 and the Oslo Agreement along with the Arab Initiative of 2002 as the best solution to the Palestinian questions. Land for peace resulted in two states living side by side in peace. It is a matter of principle. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. of the civil rights movement in the United States opposed Vietnam War in spite of President Lyndon Johnson's positive role in adopting the Civil Rights Act. He said, justice is indivisible and it should be prevailed everywhere.
Not all are convinced that Sudan has much to gain from normalizing with Israel. Ashafi Khidr, an economics professor and former leader of the Sudanese Communist Party who opposes the agreement, said the only thing to be gained from peace with Israel is the removal of Sudan's name from the terrorist list. How popular within the Sudanese community is normalization with Israel?
I think people above 40 years old are ambivalent about normalization with Israel. Some for religious beliefs, some for pan-Arabism convictions, and large number for perceiving the issue as a humanitarian one, a case of oppressed people under occupation. I do not think that there would be significant economic gains for Sudan as a result of normalization. This is an exaggeration of the situation. But even though we have some gains, making gains at the expense of other people is immoral and inhumane. We should remember that Jesus Christ said once, not live by bread alone, man.
That's Haider Haroun, former Sudanese ambassador to the United States. He spoke to VOA's senior analyst Mohammed Al-Ashanawi. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, thousands of women in South Sudan suffer from obstetric fistula. That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what are you thankful for?
I'm thankful for life. The fact that I am able to live a full life and be able to do the kind of things that I want to do.
I'm very thankful for my life, my children, and my job. My job helps me to get money. I'm very, very thankful for that.
I thank Allah for my life and for my parents.
I'm grateful because I've attained at least education. Education is going to help me get a job and get other opportunities in life.
I'm thankful for my family, my friends, my husband, my children, and all the lovely friends of mine who have been helpful to me.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. The National Minister of Gender, Child and Social Welfare says at least 60,000 South Sudanese women are suffering from fistula. Dr. Alexander Dimiti, Director General for Reproductive Health Services at the National Health Ministry, says the government is providing specialized training to young doctors who will treat women suffering from obstetric fistula. Last week, the government of South Sudan and aid agencies launched a strategic initiative to prevent and treat fistula across the country. For VOA News, Ding Magot reports from Juba.
Health officials say despite interventions to reduce maternal deaths in the country, many South Sudanese women continue to suffer from pregnancy-related complications, including fistula. They say out of the estimated 60,000 women and girls living with obstetric fistula in South Sudan, less than 1,000 have had surgical repair and treatment. Officials say even after successful surgical repairs, the condition is likely to relapse during childbirth because the spouses of the women suffering from the condition do not give them enough time to recover. Rose Konga, a fistula survivor, says she got fistula when her child died in her womb a few years ago. After an operation in Yei, Konga says she healed, but last year, she suffered fistula again.
It happened on November 21st. I was not happy. I could not sit among people or in my community. I am telling those who have this kind of thing that happened to me that mine happened twice. So I am telling them that you have to be strong-hearted and leave it to God. Don't worry too much until you want to commit suicide. My message goes to the girls of these days. Don't get pregnant when you are young. If you get pregnant when you are young, you need to go and consult a doctor.
Obstetric fistula is an injury that occurs during labor and leaves an abnormal opening between a woman's birth canal and the urinary system or rectum. It causes urinary and fecal incontinence, meaning a woman is unable to control her bowel movements or urine. Health workers say adolescent girls are particularly at risk of obstructed labor because their pelvises are not fully developed. Gender, Child and Social Welfare Minister Ayah Benjamin Warile says aside from causing injury to a woman's reproductive organs, fistula takes away a woman's dignity. To address the problem, last week the government and aid agencies launched a five-year strategy outlining interventions to prevent and treat fistula. It also provides recommendation to reintegrate women who have suffered from the condition, as women with fistula are often stigmatized in their communities.
The strategy outlines the interventions to prevent, treat, and reintegrate those who have suffered from the condition to regain their dignity and send back to their society. Universal access to reproductive health and right information and services is ensuring equal rights and opportunities for everyone, especially the women and girls.
In many cases, husbands are the first to abandon their wives when they develop obstetric fistula. Jillian Gatz Garnett, a midwifery specialist at the United Nations Population Fund, or UNFPA, says the new strategy will ensure fistula patients who normally feel shunned or excluded are reintegrated back into society.
This national strategy is a call to realize the fundamental human rights of all women and girls in South Sudan, with a special focus on those most left behind, excluded, and shunned by society. Ending fistula is a high priority for the government and for UNFPA, and it is a key step to achieving the Sustainable Development Goals.
Garnett notes, fistula has been eliminated in many wealthy countries, so it can be eliminated in every country, including South Sudan. Professor Mayen Achek, Undersecretary in the National Health Ministry, says the government will provide specialized training to 26 young doctors to treat women suffering from obstetric fistula.
Every state should have two trained obstetricians and gynecologists who could do fistula. And therefore, through this center, if we train 26 and they go out all over the place, then that's the implementation of the plan. Simple as that. And we'll have a functional gynecology operating theater.
Health officials identify Barkazal, Western Equatoria, and Lake States as having a higher prevalence of obstetric fistula compared to other states due to early child marriages. For VOA News, I am Ding Magot in Juba.
And finally to politics. With 5 days to go until voting finishes in the United States elections, the Trump and Biden campaigns are trying to drum up every last vote from their supporters. The latest average polls data show Biden leading Trump nationally by more than 7%. For more on the two candidates' campaign in the final week of the election, VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke with executive producer Steve Reddish in Washington on the final race to the White House.
President Trump has been campaigning in states in which he won in 2016 instead of trying to expand his voter appeal. He's been going back to Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania for the most part, in trying to get his own voters that he knows are supporting him, trying to drive up voter participation and voter turnout in areas that he already knows he has voters. On the other hand, Joe Biden is trying to expand the map. Tuesday, he went into Georgia. No Democrat has won Georgia since 1992. So Joe Biden sees the opportunities to add states to his electoral count, while President Trump has been backtracking and trying to make sure that the voter turnout in states that he won in 2016 will come back and vote for him again.
So basically, Trump is playing defense, trying to hold the places he won in 2016, while Biden is going on offense, trying to get more states.
Correct. Biden sees the opportunity to, much like Hillary Clinton saw in 2016, to try and add on states to what he sees as an already growing voter base, and trying to help Senate candidates and other candidates, other Democrats running in these usually red, reliably Republican states like Texas and Georgia, to try and find new voters and help local Democrats in that state raise their base. Hillary Clinton was criticized for doing this in 2016. Instead of concentrating on states that she knew and the campaign knew were going to be tight, like Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania, Hillary Clinton went and tried to grab off some voters in Texas and in Arizona.
Now, Hillary's strategy, which did not work, was in part based on polls, which showed her leading Trump by quite a bit. And again, this year, polls show that Biden is leading Trump by quite a bit. How much trust should people put in these polls?
There had been a lot of criticism about polling, especially from the 2016 election, where polls showed that Hillary Clinton was leading nationwide in the vote. And those polls reflected pretty much accurately the national vote, where Hillary Clinton won the national vote but lost in the Electoral College because she lost about three states, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, by vote margins of less than 100,000 votes in some cases, some less than 40,000 votes in other cases. The polls in those individual states were not as accurate as pollsters had hoped. For the most part, many of the polling companies that do conduct opinion surveys have changed some of their methodologies, taking into account a key demographic factor, which is the education of the electorate. The 2016 election showed that Donald Trump outperformed Hillary Clinton in a demographic category of non-college educated white men and women. And that's where his vote surged, and most pollsters did not see this coming in 2016. In 2020, they've adjusted their models, they've adjusted their methodology, and most of the observers of how polling is conducted, they're saying that, for the most part, these polls are relatively accurate. They reflect some changes in the methodology, and for the most part, many, many people are trusting the polls while still saying, but wait a minute, we saw what happened in 2016, so let's not put all of our trust in all of these polls.
That's VOA's executive producer, Steve Reddish, speaking to International Edition's Jason Patenkin. Before we end this show, I have a special announcement for you. This program can now be heard in South Sudan at 7:30 p.m. local time on VOA affiliate stations. Please inform your relatives and friends. That's all we prepared for you this Friday. We now leave you with some Baka traditional song from my hometown of Maridi in Western Equatorial State. We've been listening to some Baka traditional song from my hometown of Maridi in Western Equatorial State. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask if you must leave your house. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Yeah.
Honor.